Good afternoon. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live call-in talk show. I'm Sarah LaDuke. We have two astronomers in the studio today to answer your questions about that their final frontier. One of the best-known and most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob Berman, is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Bob and Valerie, welcome back to Vox Pop. It's great to see you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The number to call with your questions is 800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the phone number, 800-348-2551. Bob, do you want to begin by telling us about your summer tour activity?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Well, actually not in the summer because I love being here in our beautiful area for the summertime. But the tours we do, which are, of course, always astronomy, to see total eclipses of the sun, which we'll do in Spain next year, or our yearly, we've been doing this 30 years, Aurora tours, which always go to our secret places in Alaska. Why Alaska, not Scandinavia? Because it's cloudy in Scandinavia, usually 6 out of 7 nights. And boy, it's frustrating if there's a beautiful aurora, but it's overcast. So that's where we go. And that'll start next year. And I guess I can mention how people can find out.
Yes, please.
If they want to, it's... I'll just give the easy way because this will take you to the site. It would be just my name, Bob Berman Tours, and then that'll link right to where you want to go and find out what's coming up.
Search it up, Bob Berman Tours, and you will find out how you can possibly partake in some of that activity. Valerie, you sent a few space stories. We'll call them to discuss this morning as we begin. Let's start with the Andromeda one. And I'll read this, the article you sent me, I'll read a couple paragraphs to set it up and then you can both discuss. So this says, as far back as 1912, astronomers realized that the Andromeda galaxy, then thought to be only a nebula, was headed our way. A century later, so that's 2012, astronomers using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope were able to measure the sideways motion of Andromeda and found it was so negligible that an eventual head-on collision with the Milky Way seemed almost certain. A smash-up between our own galaxy and Andromeda would trigger a firestorm of starbursts, supernovae, and maybe toss our sun into a different orbit. Simulations had suggested it was as inevitable in the words of Benjamin Franklin, death and taxes. But a new study shows, using data from the Hubble and the European Space Telescope Gaia, that not so fast. Researchers combining observations from the two space observatories re-examined the long-held prediction of the Milky Way-Andromeda collision and found it is far less inevitable than astronomers had previously suspected.
Yes.
So no Andromeda apocalypse, probably.
Yeah, we think we're going to be okay. I mean, there's still, like, you know, 50-50 chance, but not, like, you know, 90-10 chance anymore.
Okay.
But it all just boils down to the fact that we have newer, better telescopes that are making more measurements about the motions of Andromeda, the motions and the positions of the surrounding galaxies that are affecting its gravitational pull and how it's moving through space. And when we can put more parameters into models and kind of project them into the future, we realize that maybe this collision that we thought was inevitable is not going to be that anymore. So we might still get hit by Andromeda, but I think the article said something like only a 4% chance of like a head-on smash collision, and then maybe a 50% chance that we'll get close enough to eventually merge. But most of it is just going to be us passing by and maybe entering into a really big orbit around each other, but not as violent of a collision as we thought.
And the estimated timeline for any of these occurrences?
Oh, like 5 billion years.
Okay.
So nobody should stress about it. It's just kind of cool to think about what's going to happen in the future.
But
I'd add that we shouldn't stress about it in any case, because let's really be clear about what's happening. Our galaxy, and Andromeda for that matter, is made up of stars separated by a lot of space. Picture the period at the end of a sentence that you might type, and the nearest period is 4 miles away. And the nearest other dot to that one is another 4 miles away. So picture 100 or a few hundred billion of those, but all separated as dots like that, separated by miles apart. Now get another conglomeration just like that and let them smash into each other. What really happens is there's a lot of empty space meeting a lot of other empty space. Mm-hmm. The odds are not a single star will collide with another star between our two galaxies, but the galaxies as a whole will gravitationally affect each other, so we'll change shape. And Andromeda and ourselves would emerge as eventually as a big elliptical galaxy. Indeed, the early universe had more spirals, just like us and Andromeda. And the current universe has more and more elliptical galaxies. So it's part of normal evolution of the universe. And so let's say we become an elliptical. Is that really something that we need to take anti-anxiety medications for? Probably not, really.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We see so much evidence in the early universe and more recently of these galaxy collisions, and they call it galactic cannibalism because it's really more like two galaxies gobbling up each other and creating one larger galaxy. So Bob is exactly right. It's like we probably wouldn't smash into another star or another solar system. We'd just merge into a larger, different type of galaxy and potentially never even really know it, aside from the fact that we'd, you know, see a lot of stars coming at us in the sky. But we wouldn't really be affected otherwise.
Yeah, we just have to change the return address on our envelopes. Although, who's sending envelopes? You know, these days there's almost no snail mail anymore. But if you do use it and your return address, you're used to Milky Way as your return address, right. You're going to have to cross that out and change that to Andromeda. That's all.
Well,
really.
Well, they've said they're going to call it Milk-omida. They're going to put them together.
Yeah,
Milk-omida. We're going to live in.
You know, really? Sarah doesn't love that.
I don't. I just think. I just think. And like, I mean, I guess we would, since we're the home team, as it were, we would want our galaxy first. But
yeah,
doesn't like.
Well, and drama way.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
And by the way, you know where this all this milk comes from? Milk has been around for a few centuries now with galaxies. Why do we even call them galaxies and ourselves a galaxy? Notice that when we're talking about things that are galactic, it has the word lactic inside of it. So there's more milk. So where this comes from originally is that when people looked up at the sky and they'd see the Milky Way, there's milk again, a creamy glow across the late summer and early fall sky. You see it nowadays at 11 to 12 o'clock if the rain ever stops, and you'll see the Milky Way. And then when we realized not that long ago that we're looking at the sideways thick portion of our own galaxy and that all other galaxies were like that, because it started even in Galileo's time, we called it Milk Avenue, Milk Road, Via Galactica, they called that in Latin, Milky Road. And so galactic comes from lactic. It's not an accident. So our Milky Way, there is really a long tradition, as if the whole universe is one big dairyland.
800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop, and you can pose your questions, should they occur to you, to Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. We will be back after this break. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman talking about astronomy. The phone number to pose your questions, 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551, or you can email us, foxpop@wamc.org. Another space story in the news provided to me by Dr. Valerie Rapson is there's a major new observatory, a major new facility. Tell us all about this place.
Yeah, this is the Rubin Observatory. There was a big press release about a month ago now showing the very first images. It's basically one of the newest telescopes that we've built. It's 8.5 meters wide. It's down in Chile. And it's cool because it's going to basically survey the southern night sky. Once every 3 or 4 days, we're going to get an entire view of the night sky, and then it's just going to repeat itself over and over. So basically, the goal is to operate this telescope for about 10 years, if not more, and take color images of the night sky over that 10-year time frame and basically detect anything that moves, anything that changes on those timescales. It's very, very cool.
what are they thinking they might find?
Well, in their first releases, they already found something like 2,300 new asteroids in like 10 hours of data. They found thousands of new asteroids in the asteroid belt. So we're looking for that. They found variable stars. And of course, they're going to photograph all the cool stuff we've seen already, you know, some galaxies and nebula. But one of the photos they released had something like 10 million galaxies in a compilation of one night's worth of photos. So it's just, it's an amazing amount of data. And it poses a really cool like computer science challenge, because we're going to have 20 terabytes of data every single night.
Wow.
And that's like way more than, you know, our laptops generally hold. So how do you store all that data and process it and let the public and the scientists use it? There's so many cool things that are going to happen and so many fun challenges that we now have to overcome.
Who is the observatory named for, and how is that determined by the scientific community?
Yeah, we were talking about this before. So this is the Vera Rubin Observatory, named after astronomer Vera Rubin. And it's one of the first of two telescopes or observatories that are named after women. So we have the Roman Telescope, which is going to launch hopefully next year, pending funding. And the Rubin Observatory this year just started. And usually they've been, historically, they've been named after male scientists. But now we have our first two telescopes named after women.
Fantastic. You sent me another story that's about the, well, I didn't ask you how do you say it out loud. Is it 31 like dash Atlas, or did you just say 31 Atlas?
31 Atlas.
31 Atlas.
Yeah.
But someone has emailed in a question about it. So we'll launch a conversation about this comment with this question. This is from Paul, who says, "Hi, folks. Can we scramble an explorer using existing technology," meaning get it ready quickly, I think, "to visit the interstellar comet 31 Atlas before it zooms away forever?
Yeah.
I know there isn't much time and it'll be on the other side of the sun in a few months, but it seems within the realm of human capability to explore this truly interstellar feat in a lifetime, once in a lifetime opportunity." Sorry.
Yeah, I think all of these discoveries of interstellar asteroids or comets in this case really should get us thinking about doing something like this. You know, we don't really have a spacecraft that we could just send up there tomorrow if we could get on a launch pad and go. It's not out of the question. We could definitely build one, but we don't have anything at the ready that can really go physically explore it. Now, we can point every telescope on the ground and in space at this thing as it comes by, and I'm sure that's exactly what we're going to do as time progresses, but we don't have anything ready yet. But maybe we should, because this is the third object in the last couple of years, right, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
We've had quite a few, and we should really like be ready to go explore them up close.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago that we didn't think that any comets came from beyond the solar system, and now we know that they do.
So tell me more about this comet, what we know about it, and why it is so exciting.
Yeah, so we don't know a whole lot. It was only discovered a few weeks ago. It's, you know, kind of way out in the solar system headed towards us. We don't have really much of an idea of like size or shape or anything because it's still too far away to really see. But it does exhibit a head and a coma, basically like a cloud around it and a little bit of a tail that tells us that it is comet-like. So it's got to be made of ices that are sublimating or heating up, turning into gases as it approaches the inner solar system. And it definitely has an orbit that is hyperbolic, meaning that it's not bound to the sun. So it's coming in from interstellar space, going to loop around the sun and leave. And the good news is it's not going to get very close. It's going to get, you know, beyond, or it's going to go, I think, between the orbit of Earth and Mars, but always be like at least 1.5 astronomical units away. So we don't have to worry about it hitting us, but it will get closer for us to study as the months go by. I think close approach was October. So October will be the good time to look.
And in this context, hyperbolic doesn't mean that this comet is prone to exaggeration.
No, not in this case.
Not in this case. We have another email here at voxpop@wamc.org from Randy, who says, "Please comment on the gravitational wave sensor array. What is the means of measuring gravitational waves that are distant and weak? And how do you get an accurate directional fix from the source of these waves, i.e. the collision of two black holes that it registered?" Mm-hmm. That's from Randy.
Do you want to start, Bob?
Well, there's an observatory in Chile that's been just set up for that. It's one of the places, actually, we take our tour groups to in between marveling at the great skies. And once again, if you can get away, even around here, just get away from cities and see the real night sky. It's just it's one of the wonders of the world that city dwellers have pretty much forgotten about because you don't see it. Unfortunately, some of the web-based things that they tell you, oh, go out and see this meteor shower, and they're talking about a minor meteor shower where almost all the meteors will be faint and you probably won't see any unless you get away from the city. So that becomes really important. But anyway, down in Chile, it's set up so that bouncing laser beams across from one article from one object to another measure the distance between them, and when a gravitational wave passes by, it'll ever so slightly, we're talking about a couple of atoms widths separation, and it'll change their distance as the wave passes through Earth. And so that can actually be measured, and it can give us a clue that gravitons or gravity waves actually exist, which this was Einstein's idea, and we didn't really confirm that until rather recently.
Right, exactly, because you're literally, when a gravitational wave comes by, you're literally stretching and compressing space-time. So as Bob said, you're looking on microscopic
scales. No, I'm not. Sounds
I know.
Dangerous.
Like, technically, they're going through us right now, and we're fluctuating just a little bit. But, you know, we have the equipment now to be able to measure these tiny microscopic changes in the position of these mirrors and the lasers to be able to detect them. And the trickiest thing, like the email mentioned, was, how do you know where they're coming from, right? Because one detector is not going to answer that question, because the way they're designed, like, they usually have two arms, so we can kind of get a rough sense of direction, but you really need at least two of these types of observatories to detect the same wave to be able to kind of start to triangulate. And the more of these observatories we build, the better we can triangulate the source. So whenever we have a new gravitational wave discovery, if only one or two facilities detected it, you'll see that they give like a strip of the sky and say, well, it came from somewhere in this, you know, 100-degree long strip, which is not very precise at all. But if multiple places detect it, then we can pinpoint it and at least say, oh, in the general direction of maybe this galaxy, this is where it came from. So that's how we can, you know, roughly do it. And then the strength of the wave is tied to the size of the black hole or the object that might have collided. So that's how we can get a sense of like what caused the gravitational wave that we're detecting.
800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Are you two ready for a call? Of course
sure.
You are.
Let's do it.
Why would? What if you said no?
Yeah, right.
No, we're actually not
doing
that today. Be like, what? Okay, let's go to Paul in Albany. Good afternoon, Paul.
Oh, hi. Hi. So my question is this. Voyager, I think it was Voyager that went out, and they got to the edge of the, the edge of the heliosphere, and reported that there was this very, very high temperature at the edge of the heliosphere. And yet we still talk about space as being cold. And I guess I was kind of puzzled by that.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of tricky. So you basically have this region, this heliosphere, heliopause area, where you have like stellar wind pushing out and you have interstellar winds coming in, and you can have this like collision boundary where you have particles that are moving at faster speeds. And because they're moving so quickly, you register them at a higher temperature, but the density is so low that yes, an individual particle is at a high temperature, but if you could just feel the ambient temperature of space, you wouldn't feel it as hot because there's only a handful of particles that are actually moving at those higher temperatures or higher speeds.
To be clear, heat is the motion of atoms or molecules.
Mm-hmm.
But heat is our word for that. So when you're touching something and it feels hot, what really is simply happening is that the molecules or atoms are jiggling faster there. And they're making your atoms and molecules on your skin jiggle faster. And when you have a fever, you could go to the doctor and say, oh, I'm feeling miserable. I have a fever of 102. Or you could say, hey, my atoms are moving 5 miles an hour faster than normal. It's making me feel awful. And he might hand you some aspirin and say, here, this will slow them down. And that's really what's happening. That's what we're talking about. So in this case, it just means that at the heliopause, the edge of the solar system, where those marvelous Voyager spacecraft penetrated to see what lies beyond the sun's sphere of influence, really, essentially, where is the point where outward flowing solar particles, which we call the solar wind, has a boundary where stuff from beyond the solar system is able to overcome that outward pushing, let's call it a bubble, and that's the boundary that they passed. So what's really happening is a change of direction of the objects that the Voyager is encountering. And so the higher temperature we're talking about just means that they're trapped in this bubble, mm-hmm. are faster moving atoms. But if you were there, you wouldn't notice a thing.
Any follow-ups, Paul?
Yeah, so that wouldn't bother a space, like you were sending a spacecraft with people in it.
No,
it wouldn't
not at all.
Be an issue there.
You wouldn't even notice it.
Yeah.
Because as Valerie said, it's too sparse. It's too not dense to mm-hmm. for you to even notice. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And if you try that system of symptom description to your doctor and they do in fact prescribe you anything, let us know. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It is Astronomy with Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman this afternoon. We have another email question from Ellen, who says, usually moonrise and set change about an hour a day. This week, much shorter intervals. Explanation? Question mark.
Bob's good at these. Go for
the moon.
Yeah, really. What determines the delay in night to night moon rising is the slant of the moon's orbit that it makes with the eastern horizon. Now, the moon's orbit is very nearly the same as the plane of the solar system, which is also the sun's apparent change from night to night among the stars. The moon is only offset 5 degrees, a negligible amount from that, but depending upon where you are on Earth and what season it is, that slant can be almost vertical. Now, we get that in the western sky in February and March, which is why the crescent moon looks like a smile at that time of year and at no other time of year, because it's vertical from the sunset night after night. And that'll also allow you the maximum delay from night to night, which is about an hour, 50 minutes, really. But again, as we know from the time of year when we have the two most famous moons, the harvest moon and the hunter's moon, that's when we suddenly have a delay that's only 20, 25 minutes from night to night of moon rises. And when that happens around the full moon, which is going to happen in September and again in October, it means that, well, the legend is that the harried farmer trying to finish his or her harvesting duties and running out of daylight. It's sunset now and you're running out of daylight, but now here comes the full moon rising just at sunset, which the full moon always does anyway, but doing that night after night for several nights in a row. And it's the same as the caller's question. It's the delay is caused by the very narrow slant that the moon's orbit makes with the eastern horizon, so that it's just not that deep under the ground one night later from the night before. So it doesn't have far to travel to reach the horizon and rise. Whereas if it was a steep path like a cannonball below the horizon, there's much more of a distance that the moon has to cover from night to night in order to clear the horizon and rise. So that's the whole story.
There you go.
It's funny you mentioned the mythology of the moon, because my summer intern for the planetarium is putting together a show all about how different cultures envision the night sky. So like Chinese culture, Native American culture, and like how it links back to our Western constellations. But I and he have learned so much about how they would view things like the moon and the constellations and link them back to the things that they had to do every day in their lives historically, and how they use the moon to track time and track the constellation for harvesting. It's also interconnected.
It really is. And that's one reason that when you hear the weather person say, well, next Saturday night, it's the strawberry moon, or it's the frost moon, or it's the wolf moon.
The beaver moon.
Exactly. And these things, actually, those are not real, because every Native American tribe had their own name for each month's full moon. Mm-hmm. So when they say this is the strawberry moon, well, technically you should say according to the Cheyenne. But according to the Sioux, it was the frost and the teepee moon. They all have different names for it. And as Valerie just pointed out, the names invariably refer to what happened at that time of year, either in nature or the things that you would be doing, mm-hmm. gathering strawberries or protecting yourself from the cold or what have you.
800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Another email question. This is from Alexandria, who says, I read an article about how the Earth is rotating faster and will affect global timekeeping. My question is how and why is that happening and what else is it going to affect?
There are only really small changes. So, you know, we are not a solid object. We are a liquid object on the interior, and the motions of the material, like the liquid iron core and whatnot, are changing. The fact that we have the moon orbiting around us, there's like tidal drag forces. So all of these things can speed up or slow down the Earth's rotation depending on exactly how things are aligned and how things are moving. So the change in Earth's rotation rate, you know, it affects our clocks by like tiny fractions of a second. So it doesn't matter for our daily lives. But if you're looking at things over millions or billions of years' time, then you really have to model all of these intricate details to understand how many physical days, how many rotations of the Earth would have gone by in that time frame. So it's just a small effect now, but it is kind of cool to look at.
That was so adroitly said, spoken perfectly. I think of very little to add to that. We spend around, not in 24 hours, incidentally, but in 23 right. hours, 56 minutes, and 4.1 seconds.
Are we just rounding that, Bob?
Yeah, we round to 24 hours. We call it 24 hours because we care about the sun in our lives, mm-hmm. not whether the star Spica is going to rise at that same clock time night after night. We don't care about the stars, which, by the way, measures out our true rotation. We can't really use the sun for true rotation because it's in a different direction every day because we're going around it. So, but we care more about the sun. It affects our lives. So if we want the sun to be at its highest point, at let's say when the clocks say noon, we have to take our true rotation and then add that extra bit of rotation time so that our noses are again pointing toward the sun, which is now in a different direction, one day later. So to do that, we've long ago added an extra 4 minutes to our spin to get the 24-hour day. That's how our clocks are set up.
How long ago? What people did this?
Well, from the beginning, they always cared about the sun.
Yes.
And not about the stars. And that's okay. We could editorialize about that being astronomers here, but that's okay. Sun is a star. Go ahead. Let it pass.
Yeah. I was trying to think. There was an article about like the oldest timekeeping calendar ever, and I could be misremembering, but I thought it was like 13,000 years old or something, and that might have been the one before they found this one. I don't remember, but like tens of thousands of years ago, let's say, people were seemingly keeping track of the sun's position, trying to come up with some time scale, whether it was 24 hours, I don't know. But they were using the moon. So it's just interesting to see that even that long ago, we were trying to figure out how things moved in the sky and how it really mattered to our everyday lives.
Yeah, because the one thing about humans is that we notice patterns. Mm-hmm. We notice rhythms. That's what we're good at. There's things we're bad at, but we're always
plenty
good.
Of things.
Yes, yes. But we're always good at repetitions and patterns. Like if the phone rings just as you're sitting down for dinner, and it does that for four nights in a row, this is not going to escape attention, your attention. So the most repetitive thing involved, of course, light was and still is the big deal for humans since we rely on sight more than any other sense, unlike, let's say, our canine friends who rely on smell far more than we do. So sight is important, therefore light is important, and we only have two useful lights, moon by night and the sun by day. And so if there is a pattern to the moon, the caller before talked about it rising about an hour later each night, we're going to pick up on that. And if the tides seem to be in sync with that, wow, are we going to pick up on that? Well, it's not going to escape attention. So it's not that the ancients were so perspicacious. It's that there was no Netflix. And what else are you going to do? What else are you going to do with your time except notice these very obvious repetitions?
Yeah, count your breaths between tides and moon rises and
exactly.
Maybe be a little bit more zen for that.
800-348-2551,
1-800-348-2551. Another underwriting break from our very generous, supportive underwriters, and then we will return with more of your questions for Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman after this. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with the amazing Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson here to talk about astronomy. The phone number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Ready for another phone call?
Yes, let's do it.
Excellent. Let's go to Jim in Connecticut. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon. My question relates to time as well. And full disclosure, I'm an old English major without a strong STEM background, but I've always been fascinated by astronomy. And I've never been able to wrap my head around the concept of time as a force, as in the space-time fabric, or the theory that the faster space vessel would go, the more accelerated time would be. And I have a daughter who reads astrophysics for fun. When we have this discussion, my premise is time is a human construct based on our anticipation of what's to come in physical space and what's already happened. And I know my daughter's right. I know Einstein's right, but I don't know why I'm wrong. How would you explain it to a non-STEM person who is reasonably intelligent?
I'd say, first of all, you're right. Even though this is an old debate, for example, Immanuel Kant thought that time was, as you say, a concept, sort of like our numbering system or the numbers on a clock, something that we use to consider changing events. Whereas others, like Newton, thought it was a real thing, a real force. And this is important because if it's a real thing, maybe it is something you could travel through time. But if it's just a concept for us, like the number three, the Greeks used to debate this like crazy. Is three real? They spent a lot of time on this. Is three a real thing or just a human idea? And eventually they'd give up, they'd laugh, they'd drink their wine, and they'd decide it was unanswerable. But so you're right. But on the other hand, if you're talking about objects traveling in space, then you need to take advantage of the fact that space and time are an amalgam when it comes to actual distances and actual motion that affects them. But you can't separate time away from that and say time is real. Most physicists would say that time is not a real thing as a standalone object. But in terms of space-time, yes, the faster you travel through one, by the way, space or time, the slower you travel through the other. So that, to use real numbers, if you traveled at 99.9999% of the speed of light, your time would pass 22,600 times slower. By the way, 22,000 is just about the number of light years from here to the center of our galaxy. So that if you did travel at that speed, just under the speed of light, which was allowable, you could get there in a year, in just a year. So your daughter's right also.
It sounds like the argument is mass discovered or do we create it? It sounds like you're saying something similar to that it really doesn't matter. 2 + 2 is still 4.
There you go.
If 2 and 4 exist.
Yeah, right. Now we're getting real philosophical here.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
Love to guess. Thank you so much for the answer.
Of course. Have a great day. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson, astronomy experts here in studio. We have an email question from Rob who says, what is the substance of space made up of? We know it can be stretched, etc. So what is space? Could we capture a bit of space somehow and perform experiments on it? Or is it beyond our understanding other than as the framework for which our universe exists inside? Could it be the dark matter that is as yet unidentified?
Well, I think the most basic way to think about it, you know, we call it the fabric of space-time because it's bendable and stretchable, as you said, but it's really just like an energy. It's like vacuum energy, which I know doesn't necessarily make more sense than a fabric, but we are still trying to fully understand this. We know that particles can go in and out of the vacuum by transferring their energy into the vacuum of space, but exactly how it works, we're still trying to figure it out. People have tried to, you know, link this dark energy, dark matter to just the fabric of space-time and chalk it up to that, but as best we understand it, that doesn't seem to be the case. We don't think it's just some, you know, extra energy that we can't see embedded in space-time that's causing what we perceive to be dark matter, for example. But we're still trying to work it out. I don't know. Do you want to add something?
It's true. And it's a paradox that astronomy, astrophysics, science has gotten to the point where we know things in relation to other things. We know them very well. And this is a way of me prefacing saying how little we know about the most important or fundamental things. But we know things like Mars spins on its axis in 24 hours, 37 minutes, and 23 seconds. And a century from now, that's not going to change. We have it down. And so there's a lot that we know. On the other hand, the basics, such as the caller's question, what is space? What is this universe? What's between the planets? You know, the quantum theory guys 100 years ago were all saying, concluding that at least one answer is consciousness, which really sounds like woo-woo. We're out in hippie left field with this. But they were serious, noting that experiments, especially the double-slit experiment and others, show that without an observer, without awareness, the experiment is different from when there is an observation. And that the observation isn't valid, the experiment is not valid unless it's being observed. So the bottom line was that consciousness, which we think of as something that animals have, including us humans, of course, no. They said consciousness is the fundamental building block of the universe, the way some of us might think of energy or time or other things. And therefore, fundamental means you can't get it from something else. You can't put two other things together and get consciousness. Consciousness is there. It's pre-existing. It's maybe always existing. And so when the caller is asking about what is space, this is, as Valerie was saying, this is a big question. Yes, we found out that it has almost unimaginable energy, which is sometimes called vacuum energy. And we're still trying to figure out if this is the same as the dark energy that we know is making the universe expand faster and faster. It's still mysterious. But beyond having energy, but otherwise not necessarily having anything, you know, we keep reading about space is expanding. Or, no, the galaxies aren't rushing away from each other. It's the space that's expanding and making them further and further apart. So it's very valid for people like the caller to say, how can nothingness, which is what we always learn space to be, how can nothingness do anything, including expand? How can nothingness expand? What does that mean? Does it have meaning? And I think Valerie and I would both say, well, kind of yes and no, and we're still working on it. We're still figuring it out. Would you say?
I think moral of the story is the simplest questions end up having the most complicated answers.
That's well said. I've never heard that before. Yeah, that's good.
And that's true. We don't have the answers yet.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
In a way. And in a way, it doesn't. 1-800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Let's go to the phones and to Kathy in Seward. Hello, Kathy.
Hi. I was wondering how often we can expect the intense solar flares that we had not too very long ago that disrupted broadcasting. Mm-hmm. I know I lost my radio, my TV for a while. I'm, you know, just in the air. No cable stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How often do those happen?
Well, they definitely, they're hard to predict, first of all, but they happen relatively rarely. We have seen them happen, you know, two or three times in the last year or so because we're currently at solar maximum, so the sun is its most active, and we can expect more of these flares and energetic events to happen. So during solar maximum, you might see the most extreme ones maybe two or three times a year, and at solar minimum, you might not see any types of those events for a couple of years. So the entire cycle takes like 11 years, this up and down of activity, but at most you'll expect it to happen two or three times a year.
Okay.
And also, we haven't even had the worst of it or the most powerful.
That's true.
In 1859, it was the famous Carrington event where Richard Carrington in England observed the most powerful solar flare ever seen through an amateur 6-inch telescope. We call it the Carrington event. Then in 1921, we had an event that was so powerful that telegraph operators, because of the solar flare generating electricity along metal things like pipelines and electric wires and telegraph wires, telegraph operators were knocked off their seats, some of them knocked unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
A fire was started in New York City that set fire to an apartment house because of the New York Central Railway's electric lines that were carrying the current from a solar flare. If one of those happened, it's estimated that the entire grid of the United States could be knocked out. So fortunately, even though we've had the inconveniences that the caller has just mentioned, we have not had, happily, what we could have from the sun. And every 11 years, as Valerie's pointed out, we get a period of more intense solar activity and more intense auroral activity, and we're in that right now.
Okay, one more little bit of a question. Anything to really watch out for in the next couple of years that's going to be, like, fantastic?
I would always say a total eclipse of the sun, because in all the tour groups over these last 30 years, what makes people weep, what I've seen, you know, ordinary people, we're not talking about astronomers, but what makes people, brings them to tears, the top events, so that I'm going right to that for the caller's question. I assume you don't have a telescope, you don't want to bother with star charts, so I'm not going to talk about how Saturn's rings are returning or how beautiful it is to see Orion return every October. No, we're talking about like the cream of the cream. And so total solar eclipses. Now, we've had that one in the United States. We're not going to have another U.S. eclipse until 2045. So you'll have to travel. You could join us or another tour company, or go yourself to Spain next year in mid-August. The Aurora Borealis is up on that top five list, of course. And this is these years are the best years for it because of the solar maximum. A great meteor shower. Now, don't be misled by the web, which often says, go out and see the Lyrid meteor shower this weekend. But it's a full, they don't tell you it's a full moon, and it's going to block most of the meteors. And the Lyrids are very skimpy to begin with. I mean, a major meteor shower, you'll see one a minute. A minor meteor shower, you might see one every 20 minutes, and it might be dim. And if it's a full moon, you won't even see it. So you have to be careful with that. So meteors are great, but, you know, stick with the Perseids every August 11th and the Geminids. This year, the Geminids are going to be particularly good on December 13th. Now, you know, of course, standing outdoors in December, at least around here, not everybody's up for that. But if you are, go for that. And I guess I'm getting long-winded now, so I'll stop.
Perseids in August, though?
Perseids on August 11th, but it's going to be almost a full moon this year, so that's going to wash them out to a degree.
Darn that moon.
Yeah.
I feel you.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. Have a great afternoon.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's try to get another call in. We'll go to Tom in Bennington. Hello, Tom. Tom, you're on.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the radio.
Hey, do you feel... when you're in space, do you feel speed if you're going like 100 miles an hour compared to like light speed or warp speed or whatever you want to call it? Would you feel it?
No. It's like being on an airplane, right? Your airplanes are going a couple hundred miles an hour and you don't feel like you're moving at all. So it's the same kind of thing. What you feel is the acceleration, the speeding up, like when you get smushed in the back of your seat when you ride a roller coaster because you're speeding up. That's what you feel. But once you get to that maximum speed, it doesn't matter how fast you're going. You perceive it as not moving at all because you're inside the spaceship.
800. That's yeah, that's it. That's it. No, you don't feel speed in space. We have another email question I'll get to from Alice, who says, please explain in layman's terms, and I'll add in a couple of minutes because we're almost out of time. Magnetic. I know. Magnetic north and true north. Why and how adjustments would be made determining a travel destination. I thought it might be a good couple minute one.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Where compasses point is magnetic north, and because that follows the magnetic lines. Now, the magnetic north pole is where the magnetic lines go vertical into the ground. Elsewhere, they're horizontal along the surface of the ground, and that's what a compass will show. And but that's not the same place as the true north, which is where Santa lives. And well, okay, let's stick with science. That's the place that isn't rotating. That's the place, if you stood there, you'd be standing there feeling kind of like an idiot because you wouldn't be moving. You'd just be kind of, in 24 hours, you'd make one spin, but you'd be still glued in place.
And well, and frozen.
It's very different from, let's say, here. We're talking about upstate New York, where we're moving at about 760 miles an hour, which coincidentally is the speed of sound. So we're whizzing at the speed of sound. At the equator, you go 1,030 miles an hour. So different speeds for different locations, of course.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Can you say a little bit more about it?
Okay. So the North Pole of the geographical North Pole is simply 90 degrees north. It's, you can't go further north from that, or put another way, once you stand there, any direction you walk is south. So it's a very special spot. But always hundreds of miles from there, and for many years it was in or just off the coast of Ellesmere Island in Canada, is where the magnetic lines converge. And that's the other pole. Now, that's the one that keeps drifting and changing, by the way. For a long time, it moved 5 miles a year. Lately, it's been moving 35 miles a year, and it's heading due north. And if it keeps going that way, it's going to go clear across the Arctic Ocean over the geographical North Pole and down into Russia. So it's already not the property of Canada. And when I did an article in Discover about this some years ago, and I spoke to an official in Canada, they said they're glad that they no longer have the magnetic North Pole, because now they don't have to rescue people that they used to be responsible for, adventurers who were trying to get to the North Pole, the magnetic North Pole. Now it's in international waters and they don't have to bother with it.
We're out of time for today on Vox Pop. Thanks to Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson for stopping by. And thank you all out there for listening. Support for Vox Pop comes from Max Agway Farm and Garden, Red Hook. Pet friendly with collars, leashes, plus foods like Wellness and Blue Buffalo for fur babies to choose from. On Firehouse Lane, maxagway.com. And Crisafulli Brothers Home Services, proudly providing heating, cooling, plumbing, and electrical services throughout the Capital Region and North Country since 1939. CRISBRO.com. Thank you again for joining us today for Vox Pop. Our engineer, as ever, has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by the marvelous Susie Checkeye, and I'm Sarah LaDuke, Infrared Graph. Tomorrow, Food Friday, 2 p.m. Talk to you then.